Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Summer is blockbuster season for movies. Holiday movies tend to be sequels or seasonal, family-driven plots. Fall is different. It's time for more serious, dramatic films fresh off the festival circuit and aiming to catch the eye of critics. So, on this fall day, we turn to the Cahiers du Cinéma, which at one time was the journal not only for film criticism, but for inciting a wholesale reevaluation of film. Founded in Paris in 1951, the Notebooks of Film, as translated into English, championed the French New Wave and poo-pooed the American Technicolor movies of the era, along with film noir and anything by Hitchcock. The international arts publishing house Fiden purchased the Cahiers du Cinéma and has released a series on the craft of acting called Anatomy of an Actor. When we talked to Philip Masiak earlier this year, coffee table-sized books exploring why the performance of Jack Nicholson, Meryl Streep, Al Pacino, and Marlon Brando were so memorable had been published. Now there are 6 volumes. So back to that conversation with Philip Masiak, who wrote about the Anatomy of an Actor series for Slate. Philip Masiak, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, first, a little background on the series and the Cahiers du Cinéma. Fiden purchased Cahiers in 2009, already produced a series on great directors. What do you think they were aiming for with the focus on actors?
Well, I think that the director's art has been, over the past decades, an art that has been really thoroughly examined empirically. I think we know how directors create shots. We know a great deal because of periodicals like the Cahiers du Cinéma and interviews with directors. We know a great deal about how directors approach their craft, and we see them to some extent as craftsmen. We see them as people who are measuring things, lighting things, and sort of using the tools at their disposal to create a work of art. And I think that acting, to some extent, has not received as extended a treatment in that regard as directing has. You know, we talk about method acting as the sort of most famous way that we can think about actors, but even that process, which is a process, is shrouded in a kind of illusion. They replayed a great Philip Seymour Hoffman interview with Terry Gross last week, and he called it acting mumbo jumbo. And I think that that's really right about the way that the public perceives the actor's craft, that it is a kind of magical thing, right? You close your eyes, you put your hand over your face, and all of a sudden you create a part. Whereas I think there's a great deal more labor and intellect that goes into it that we don't explore quite so much.
Film acting is the last great mystery of the contemporary cinema, is how you put it in your article. But can this mystery be so easily described or even understood?
I mean, I think that's the great question, and that's one of the reasons why I think that aspect gets a little bit of a short shrift. It isn't as technical as the director's work, and so it's often more difficult, I think, for actors to describe what precisely they're doing. The book that I focus on primarily in the article, this about Meryl Streep by the wonderful critic Karina Longworth, that's one of the reasons this book succeeds, is because Meryl Streep is so sort of phenomenally articulate about all of the thought that she puts into the roles that she creates, both at the level of, you know, scene work. So, you know, what am I thinking about when I'm doing the scene? How am I creating this accent? But also at the level of where the role fits into a larger cultural narrative. Mm-hmm. Meryl Streep is extraordinarily articulate and extraordinarily smart about the way that she approaches her roles as sort of political acts.
Well, let's dig into this then. The series, sure. Anatomy of an Actor, it's contemporary critics concentrating on 10 performances each. We mentioned Jack Nicholson, Al Pacino, Marlon Brando, and Meryl Streep. So let's look at Meryl Streep. Big breakthrough role as Linda in Michael Cimino's 1978 film, The Deer Hunter, followed shortly by Oscars for Kramer versus Kramer, and shortly after that, Sophie's Choice. Now, here is a scene that you write about, the courtroom scene from Kramer versus Kramer. Let's roll this. This is Meryl Streep as Joanna Kramer. She's on the stand making the case why she should have custody of her son.
I'm not saying he doesn't need his father, but I really believe he needs me more. I was his mommy for 5 and a half years. And Ted, took over that role for 18 months. But I don't know how anybody can possibly believe that I have less of a stake in mothering that little boy than Mr. Kramer does.
Meryl Streep, their eyes convincingly welling up with tears. Walk us through that clip in the larger courtroom scene. What is Streep drawing on there?
Well, I think that one of the narratives that's most compelling that Longworth draws in her book about this and in her close attention to the scene is that Meryl Streep, in her early career, as many actresses were during this period, faced with a lot of roles that were underwritten. And one of the things that Meryl Streep really appeared to put a lot of energy into doing was exercising the sort of small amount of power that her talent had given her to try to shape these roles into more well-rounded roles, to roles that spoke more of women's experiences. And this scene in particular is a really great example of that, because she entered into this film, Kramer versus Kramer, which as a popular novel beforehand had a kind of reputation as a novel about sort of female villainy to some extent, about how this woman could leave her family. And she felt very, very committed to the idea that this was a character whose choices were understandable, whose choices were worth thinking about. And she was actually given in this scene the opportunity to write her own dialogue. And I think that's why it makes a particularly good example of what Meryl Streep has been so good at, is simply making roles her own, in this case, literally.
Philip, her quick rise to fame has sparked a couple of backlashes through the years. There was a time when she was accused of getting paid too much. You know, it said she couldn't open a film. She was too serious. And then when she made a comedy, she was not a comedian. But reading the comments of your review, the biggest issue people seem to have with Meryl Streep is her accents. What's going on here?
I feel like this is to some extent the side problem that results from us not really talking that much about acting craft. The one thing that anybody can zero into when talking about how an actor produces a work is whether or not they're doing an accent. And I think for Meryl Streep especially, because she's done such a wide array of different types of accents and become sort of famous for it, that becomes very easily a thing that people who either are objecting to the work that she does or don't particularly care for her as an actress, to zero in on that particular element of any performance and say, oh, she's just doing that accent again. It's as you said, difficult to describe why a particular performance is great, but there are a lot of resources at hand for people in comment sections to talk about why a performance is bad.
Philip Masiak is with us. He teaches film studies at LSU, and he also wrote a review about Fiden's Anatomy of an Actor series. He wrote about it for Slate. We're kind of looking at that performance with the Academy Awards just coming up. Let's talk about the man that Streep is rumored to have had an affair with during their filming of Ironweed, Jack Nicholson. This book by Beverly Walker. What makes Jack Nicholson worth studying? He doesn't seem to have had the same sort of academic approach to acting as Meryl Streep did, certainly.
There was a particular comment in the comment section that I thought was a particularly interesting way of thinking about the difference between the two characters. Somebody said the difference between Meryl Streep and Jack Nicholson is that Meryl Streep is an actor and Jack Nicholson is a movie star. And I think that one of the things that becomes interesting about Jack Nicholson is that after a certain point, his phenomenal run of great roles in the 70s, the reputation he had for those roles began to be matched by his public persona. And I think it produces both something interesting and also a challenge in writing about actors who are also extraordinary celebrities, because it bifurcates the subject. You have two things that you can write about.
He's one of that small club of actors who has won 3 Oscars, one in the 70s, one in the 80s, and one in the 90s, interestingly enough. Here he is in one of the strongest performances, to my mind, that great run in the 70s with the Chinatown, you know, 5 Easy Pieces, The Last Detail, and this one. He is playing Randall McMurphy in the film adaptation of Ken Kesey's novel One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest from 1975.
Do you think it might be possible to turn that music down so maybe a couple of the boys could talk?
That music is for everyone, Mr. McMurphy.
Yeah, I know, but you think we might ease it down a little bit so maybe the boys didn't have to shout? Huh?
What you probably don't realize is that we have a lot of old men on this ward who couldn't hear the music if we turned it lower. That music is all they have. Your hand is staining my window.
Sorry, ma'am.
All right. Sorry. Mr. McMurphy.
Huh?
Your medication.
Oh, the withering Nurse Ratched, played by Louise Fletcher there at the end. But this is the thing, that people say that Jack Nicholson doesn't act anymore. He's just Jack Nicholson playing Jack Nicholson. So is this it, Philip? Is the true test of an actor forgetting who they are in a role?
I'm not sure if that's the true test, but it's certainly something that plays into it. And I think it's one of the things that people, I mean, as much as I say in the article that we need to move away from the model of thinking about acting as magic, and thinking about it instead as work or as a craft or as something with a distinct process. I mean, I think that's not to deny the fact that there is something sort of magical about acting, and part of that is the idea of forgetting that that someone is playing a particular role. And I think Jack Nicholson has certainly played a fair number of roles that could easily have been characters based on Jack Nicholson. You see something even later in life in a film like Something's Got to Give with this sort of aging Lothario. But then you look at something like About Schmidt, where he plays in Alexander Payne's great film, he plays a sort of, you know, diminished version of himself. And in that film, I find it pretty easy to forget that that's Jack Nicholson.
Well, Philip, you did not review the books on the other two great actors in this series, Al Pacino and Marlon Brando. But I am curious to know about the field of actors that is out there now. Where are they picking up from the greats, and where are they departing?
Well, I think that one of the things that you see, you know, we don't talk about Christian Bale necessarily as a method actor, but we certainly see the kind of
extreme weight loss and gain.
the extreme weight loss and gain, the hair pieces, his American accent, which sounds suspiciously like Robert De Niro's American accent, really sort of put him, I think, almost self-consciously in the lineage of those sort of actors of the new Hollywood. I think it's really interesting to see someone like Matthew McConaughey, especially thinking as we just were about the career of Jack Nicholson. One of the really interesting things that that Walker really draws out in her book is about how formative Nicholson's early years in the Roger Corman company were. He was acting in these sort of pulpy movies and in many cases writing them, and really sort of working on his craft in movies that were not great movies. And Bruce Dern, the same thing is true of Bruce Dern. And I think that Matthew McConaughey was not certainly in sort of pulpy films, but he did this long stretch in the popular romantic comedy where, you know, he was, I think, often accused of, you know, just showing up for a paycheck and not really being that interested. And one of the narratives that's emerged over the past couple of years during what various critics have called the McConaissance is the idea that he's beginning to be interested in his work again. And he said things to that effect in interviews as well. And I think that what's really fascinating to watch here is an actor who had essentially been acting on autopilot for a little while. And we're seeing what he's capable of doing when he really locks in, when he really starts thinking about roles and the kind of diversity of roles that he's been able to play on, certainly in Dallas Buyers Club, but also in True Detective, which I would suggest is one of the best performances that he's done to really, again, show this kind of control and show the choices that he's making as an actor.
And you would know, you're right down there in Southeast Louisiana, Southwest
Louisiana.
Where all
television programs are set.
That's our earlier conversation with Philip Masiak, professor at Louisiana State University and author of the Dear Television column at the Los Angeles Review of Books. You know that little so-and-so is typing alert that appears on your screen while you're instant messaging with a friend? Well, up next, the software engineer who helped develop that typing indicator and who frequently finds himself defending the invention. That conversation when word of mouth continues. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. You know that feeling when you and a friend are in conversation over text? You've just composed and then sent a brilliant little message, and this little bubble with the blinking dots shows up on your phone, indicating that your friend is typing. So you wait in anticipation, maybe only to receive a two-word response, ha-ha, or worse, No response at all. If that drives you crazy, David Auerbach may be to blame. He's a software engineer and critic, and he writes the weekly Bitwise column for Slate. He helped design the typing indicator now used on everything from GChat to the iPhone. And he is not apologizing, as his recent column for Slate says, brazenly enough. I built that so-and-so is typing feature in chat, and I'm not sorry. David Auerbach, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So the so-and-so typing feature is just one of those things that seems to have been around forever. When did you develop it?
Well, it was me and a couple other people on the MSN Messenger team at Microsoft back in 1998 and 1999. It eventually shipped in 1999.
Wow, so in early 1999, early 2000s, that was when people weren't texting. We were using dial-up for the most part. So give us a snapshot of what instant messaging was like back in those dark ages.
There were a couple apps around then. There's AOL's. There was a program called ICQ, which the old timers might remember. But, you know, broadband was not particularly widespread at the time. And so people were not always logged on. And worse, dial-up had a habit of cutting out. Sometimes call waiting would be enough to kick you off, offline.
Right.
And so for a lot of reasons, you would get into situations where you would be chatting with a friend over instant message, and there'd be a pause in between messages. Either you wouldn't be sure who it was who was supposed to be responding, whether, you know, the other person was going to say something more or whether it was your turn. Or even worse, you could see that they were online when they'd actually been cut off. So the thinking was to have a little message that said whether or not the person on the other end was currently just typing text, whether or not they'd sent it to you yet. In its initial form, it would be a message that said, you know, X is typing a message. So the little icon and flashing dot, dot, dots came later. That was how it was initially envisioned. And it turned out to be quite a hit and was copied, I think, by pretty much all the competitors pretty quickly.
Well, our technology has leapfrogged forward since that. How about this interpretation of the typing indicator? Do people still see it in the same way?
Some people seem annoyed by it. I think etiquette on instant messaging has developed to the point where I think people have a lot better sense of the back and forth. But depending on who you talk to, some people seem to say, oh, I love it. It gives me more feedback on what I'm doing. Other people say, oh God, it's horrific. I wish it was not there. It makes me feel like I'm not typing fast enough, or it makes me feel like the other person knows that I might be typing too much. So if I then erase it all, they then knew that I was typing a lot. And I would say that in our defense, we allowed you to turn off the feature. And I don't think most programs these days give you much of a choice.
So as a developer, it was certainly successful. And as we said in the title of your article, you're not apologizing for helping to develop the so-and-so is a typing feature in chat. How about you personally, as a user? How do you feel about your own invention?
Well, I do want to give credit to the handful of people. It was a couple people on the team, so it was not just me. So a shout out to some people who might want to remain nameless, but I remember you, and it was good times back then. I like it. I like having lots of feedback. I type very fast, so if anything, I wish there was more feedback. There used to be a program called Talk. And in that, you would see what the other person was typing character by character. It wouldn't be message by message. And so you could sort of guess what the other person was saying before they even finished typing it.
What I find so interesting is that kind of cross-typing phenomenon. You know, like you'll be having a conversation with somebody and they'll start typing something. You'll start answering the old thing, see that they're typing and think they've moved on to another thing. And you don't know where we are in the conversation. What can we do about that?
Oh, well, it's just like what we're doing right here, right now.
That's such a strange phenomenon, David, talking to each other.
I know. Well, if we could talk at the same time, you know, that would be even faster. But but I suppose talking is good in its old-fashioned way.
Dot, 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 I'm thinking of a response. It also sort of glosses over the nuances of a real conversation, obviously, when you're texting each other. Do you think you might be a part of a team that develops a sarcasm font?
Well, okay, here's something that wasn't in the article I'll tell you, which is that I was also the person who did the thing that turns text smileys into graphical smileys.
David Auerbach, you're the winner of the internet.
Well, it is possible someone in South Korea came up with that before I did it, but I'm pretty sure I was the first in this country in the Western world to do it.
David Auerbach, I want to thank you for illuminating that for us today. Appreciate your time.
Okay, thank you.
David Auerbach is software engineer and critic. He writes the weekly Bitwise column for Slate on technology. Up next, is there a planet out there in the vast cosmos that is just like ours? We'll hear about the search for the so-called Goldilocks planet. Not too hot, not too cold, but just right. That conversation after the news.
Word of
mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of
mouth. This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. In his Washington Post review of Lee Billings' book, 5 Billion Years of Solitude, the astronomer Mike Brown compressed the age of the Earth into a human lifetime. In just the past 2 weeks, he wrote, primates came down from the trees and learned to navigate among the planets. In the past few minutes, they figured out that the stars in the sky are suns like our own. 10 seconds ago, they realized that those suns have planets around them. And within the next minute, it seems likely that they will discover the first evidence of life on those planets in the sky. We are in that minute, according to the fast-growing field of exoplanets, the search for planets outside of our solar system, with the idea that discovering one just like ours is a real possibility. Science journalist Lee Billings writes about the fate of our planet and the scientist on the leading edge of identifying whether there are so-called Goldilocks planets, not too big, not too small, not too hot, not too cold, that can sustain life just like ours out there in the cosmos. Lee is on the line with us to talk about his book, 5 Billion Years of Solitude. Thank you for being here.
Virginia, it's great to be here.
Lee, I wonder if you could start off by reading just the first paragraph of your book, which kicks off this wonderful narrative of the evolution of the known universe. Now, this is some 4.6 billion years ago. Let's begin, please, with the very birth.
This story properly begins 4.6 billion years ago, with the birth of our solar system from a cloud of cold hydrogen and dust several light years wide. The cloud was but a wisp from a much larger mass of primordial gas, a stellar nursery manufacturing massive stars destined to explode as supernovae. One by one, the giant stars popped off like firecrackers, ejecting heavy elements that sizzled with radioactivity as they rode shockwaves through the murk like so much scattered confetti. One of those enriching shockwaves may have compressed the cloud, our cloud, in its passage. The cloud became dense enough for gravity to seize control, and it collapsed in on itself. Most of its material fell to its center to form a hot, simmering protostar. Eventually, the protostar gained enough mass to kindle a thermonuclear fire at its core, and the sun began to shine. What was left of the cloud settled around the newborn star in a turbulent, spinning disk of incandescent vapor.
Lee Billings reading from the opening of his book, 5 Billion Years of Solitude. And thank you for that, Lee. I actually understood it while I was reading it. Where are we now in this evolution?
Well, we're kind of at the brink of amazing discoveries, potentially. The reason why I wrote the book right now was because we've been finding hundreds and actually now thousands of planets beyond the solar system, so-called exoplanets. And there's no real sign that the numbers of discoveries are going to slacken anytime soon. So you could soon be envisioning a world in which we know of tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands even, of other solar systems, other planetary systems. And what that really means is that for the first time in the history of the biosphere, and perhaps the history of the universe, we're on the cusp of really discovering, in some sense, whether or not we're special and whether or not we're alone, and all these kind of deep, timeless existential questions. We have a chance of answering them And that was really, I think that's where we are now, and that's why I wrote the book.
I'm reading about more than 900 exoplanets have been identified in the past 20 years, another 1,000 suspected, new candidates appearing almost every week. Tell us how this field is pursued. How do we know where to go and look?
Well, we know now, based on some of those statistics you mentioned, that the sheer number of planets we've found through the relatively short time we've been looking, that we can look anywhere. We can look at essentially any star in the sky, and if we look hard enough, chances are we'll find some planets around it. The way that we find planets is through mostly indirect methods. We're mostly looking at the stars themselves because the planets are so faint and dim. We can't really see them directly most of the time. So instead, we're just looking for fluctuations of starlight, wobbling stars or stars that slightly dim every now and then from a planet passing across their face and casting a shadow towards Earth. And these indirect effects are how we have detected most of the vast majority of planets that we now know beyond the solar system.
So we know, or can at least predict, that at some point our planet will cease to exist. So for very practical reasons, our successors will need a home. In that way, the search for life in the distant reaches of the universe is no less than making sure that life itself continues. Is that, in general, how the scientists that you spoke with consider the search for life on other planets?
Well, maybe in their quiet nighttime moments, I think so. I wouldn't say that all of them see that as the forefront or the primary reason, perhaps, for why they do what they do. But it was definitely, again, a core thing for me when I was trying to write the book, just this notion that, you know, we don't really know right now where we kind of stand in the big scheme of things. And it could be, it's entirely plausible that we may be essentially alone in the Milky Way in terms of complex life, whatever you want to call it, intelligence, civilization, these sorts of things. And if that's the case, it kind of goes against centuries of thought in the physical sciences, which have said that we're average, we're ordinary, we don't matter, and everything out there is going to be just like it is here. And if that is the case, and we are practically alone, maybe in the galaxy or our region of the galaxy, if not the observable universe, then it seems that we have some kind of responsibility, I think, to try to preserve this little spark of life and light that we have here and extend it as we can. And that's obviously going to be important in the far future. But the point is, we do have actually some sense of an expiration date for life on Earth, if for no other reason than that the sun will someday cease to shine.
We're guessing 5 billion years from now?
5 billion years from now, the sun is supposed to swell up into what's called a red giant, and it will engulf most of the inner planets and melt them down to slag. And long before that, though, life on Earth will have probably wound down and essentially ended. And that could actually come as soon as 500 million years from now, which may sound like a long time, but in the lifespan of the Earth, that's basically like telling a 45-year-old woman that she has 5 years left to live. So our planet and the possibilities for complex life upon it are actually kind of already middle-aged and even elderly, perhaps. So we really don't have a lot of time left.
Not a great story. But you introduce us to several scientists who are working on finding life in other places, including Frank Drake. He's now professor emeritus at UC Santa Cruz. He was at a SETI conference back in 1961 when he came up with what is known as the Drake equation. Now, how did Frank Drake pursue that search?
Well, essentially, Frank Drake is best known as the, I think as you alluded right there, as the founder of SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. In mid-century, 20th century, he pointed a radio telescope at two sun-like stars, Tau Ceti and Epsilon Eridani, and listened for radio signals coming from them, basically thinking that perhaps in the same way that we pump radio signals and TV signals and things like that out into the cosmos, maybe some other people around other nearby stars were doing that. And Frank Drake started laying down these various variables that would pin down the chances of this search being successful. And so that incorporates things like how often stars are formed, how often planetary systems are formed around those new stars, how many habitable planets may exist in any given planetary system, how often life occurs and arises on those planets, how often that life progresses to intelligence and then to technology and something that can build radio telescopes or rockets and things like that. So you string all these variables together, and in theory, you get this number at the end, and that number should be the number of civilizations that may exist right now in our Milky Way that we could detect. And what he found was that the most important variable was not, in fact, the number of planets or the number of stars or how often life even got started. The most important numbers seem to be how long a civilization, a technological civilization like ours, actually exists, how long it survives. And that number, that variable in the equation is called L. So in some sense, the search for other life is really a search for our own future. We're trying to figure out how long we can persist, where we're going to go in the future. And we're looking out there into space and the depths of it, and we're trying to see things that are perhaps more advanced than us and where we might go someday.
Well, despite the importance of that search or that quest, when you visited Frank at SETI Institute, it looked as if it were in hibernation, you write. You know, there are weeds growing around these radio telescopes. And much of this story of the passion and mechanics of the search for exoplanets is also about the failures that go along the way, many for lack of funding and lack of political will. Can you locate that shift when funding or the pursuit of that discontinued, at least on a federal level, and who's picking it up?
Well, it's really been a slow slide. It's been a process of gradual decay. So, for instance, NASA and the federal government of the United States hasn't actually funded any SETI searches since 1992. So you could say that that's one cutoff point. But more recently, with the advent of what I like to call the exoplanet boom, there were several telescopes that were planned by NASA and several other space agencies, and they ended up being canceled for lack of funding. So the point is that there's no singular date you can pinpoint, but there's been a lot of, I guess, setbacks. And in terms of who's picking it up or where it's being picked up, that's a really good question. I'm not quite sure what the answer is. These are very, very difficult tasks. It's a very difficult thing to whether you're trying to go out and find another civilization out there, or whether you're trying to just look for simple life on a planet very, very far away. It's not easy to do, and it's very expensive.
We're speaking with Lee Billings, science journalist. His work has appeared in Nature, New Scientist, and Scientific American, among other places. We're talking about his book, 5 Billion Years of Solitude. It is about the exoplanet boom and the search for life in any form on other planets far, far, far outside of our solar system. Lee, some of the other challenges are not in funding, but you alluded to it earlier about timing or perspective. You point out that if we were observing Earth from somewhere among the million stars of the Andromeda, we would see the Earth of 2.5 billion years ago. So at that point, forerunners of the Homo sapiens were producing stone tools, and go on from there, how the birth and evolution of our planet would look differently depending on where you sit in the universe. Can you go through that for us? It's so fascinating.
Well, sure. Yeah. So our galaxy is about 100,000 light years wide or so. So that means that on the other side of the galaxy, there's light right now from our planet, from our star, from our solar system that is trickling through the other side of the galaxy right now, and that light is about 100,000 years old. So if you think about what was happening on the planet 100,000 years ago, well, I guess you could talk to a geologist or a paleontologist, but I don't think there was a lot in terms of radio conversations or high technology. So what's important to think about is that in some ways, people or things out there very far away could know that we're here in some sense. But when I say we, I don't necessarily mean Virginia Prescott and Lee Billings. It would be more along the lines of knowing that the Earth was alive.
But that leads to the questions that planetary scientist Jim Castings discusses with you, that if we are searching for among exoplanets for signs of life, would we recognize it if we found it? You know, we might be looking at the analog planet 3 billion years ago. Would we say, oh, that's gonna turn into something?
Right, and that's a very good point. And this is something that researchers struggle with a lot, because usually in science, you don't want to base all of your extrapolations and all of your experiments off of a sample size of one. You don't want to just have one instance that you're, you know, drawing everything from. We really want to find a lot of other living planets, a lot of other habitable planets. And then if we did that, we would have a better idea of what the constraints actually are for life and what life in all its diversity can actually look like and how it manifests on planets. And we don't have a really good idea of that yet. So in some sense, you can look at the Earth's history, as Jim Casting has, and you can see that, you know, let's look 3 billion years ago. 3 billion years ago, the Earth had a pretty thriving biosphere. Things were relatively alien here. You and I wouldn't want to go back there and try to live there. We'd suffocate because there's no oxygen in the atmosphere, or there's very little of it. But at the same time, there was a thriving biosphere from microbes, single-celled organisms that could do things like metabolize all kinds of things like sulfur or hydrogen and use sunlight to split that stuff. And they, some of them would produce methane. And there was a bunch of methane in the atmosphere. So you could think, well, maybe methane is a biosignature from back then. But it's very tricky. And the point, I think, really is that we have to start from what we know. We're unfortunately blinkered in our view, but that's just the best we have. We have to base our search on what life seems to be like here because we know it pretty well. We understand it pretty well. And consequently, when we're looking for life out there, we're mostly looking for Earth-like planets. Even in our solar system, there's obviously other chances for life. Maybe there's life on Mars. Maybe there's life, in particular, in the ice-locked oceans of some of the moons in the outer solar system, like Jupiter's Europa or Saturn's Enceladus, things like that. But the thing is, and the trouble is, with those sorts of places, we could envision life being there, but if it's locked beneath a big shell of ice, for instance, how the heck are we going to detect it across the light years? So that's another reason why looking for an Earth-like planet is very attractive, because in that case, life would be all over the surface. It would, in theory, be ejecting byproducts of its metabolism into the atmosphere, these so-called biosignatures, and we could thus detect that from very, very far away using telescopes.
So we have things like we have telescopes, we have the Kepler mission, which is because of mechanical failure has been shuttered, at least temporarily. The plans for a terrestrial planet finder or TPF are looking pretty unlikely. Is this field losing steam, Lee Billings?
No. For Virginia, it's not. It's actually full steam ahead. The question is, it just depends on what we're trying to find. We're going to be finding a lot of planets. There's no sign of that slowing down. Planets are pouring out of the sky. They'll continue to do so for the foreseeable future. And that's because we've gotten really, really good at finding them, both from the ground and in space. But there will be what we risk, and this is a key thing that I wrote the book about. We risk a disconnect in between finding and detecting, discovering all these planets, and actually knowing what they're like. So in the very near future, it's entirely possible that you could walk outside, anyone on Earth could walk outside, and they could look up at the night sky. They could look at essentially any star in the sky, as we said earlier, and point to one of those stars and say, hey, we know that there's an Earth-mass, Earth-sized planet in the so-called habitable zone over there. It could be just like Earth. And they could do this for stars all across the sky they can point to. But we aren't actually going to know what they're like, and it'll just be a mystery. And the question is, do we want to go out there and actually discover what these places really are like? And whether or not they're really like Earth, whether or not they really have life, or if we're just going to be content to have that be a mystery.
Lee Billings, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Virginia.
Lee Billings is a science journalist and author of 5 Billion Years of Solitude. The book is going to be out in paperback this month. You'll find a link to read more of Lee's work at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Space may be the final frontier, but there is still vast, unexplored territory right here on Earth in the world's oceans. Up next, an oceanographer goes hunting for sound in the darkest depths of the ocean, the bottom of the Mariana Trench. That story after a short break. Please stay with us. This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. And now we cast our eyes downward to an unexplored frontier right here on Earth, to the very deepest depths of the world's oceans. One intrepid oceanographer attempted to capture something no human ear had ever heard, sound from the Mariana Trench. Annie McEwen brings us his story.
When David Barclay was just 25 and relatively new to the world of oceanography, he built a one-of-a-kind machine to try to record the deepest sounds in the ocean.
The ocean's a wild, harsh place, so trying this sort of new, pretty risky thing, people might have thought I was young and naive, which maybe I am.
So why record sound in the ocean in the first place?
When you listen to the noise, you get some idea of the mechanism that made the noise. But you also get an idea about all the water in the ocean that it propagates through.
Deep sea recordings are always done with hydrophones. That's underwater microphones tied with huge cables to a ship or a buoy. This equipment is really expensive and heavy and can't even reach the deepest parts of the ocean. So David thought,
what if you just built a little pod that had microphones on it, and you just threw it over, and it would just go down and up by itself.
He created a glass sphere half the size of a basketball. Hydrophones connected to the sphere record sound as it sinks down. When it's time to resurface, the pod releases an iron weight, and it floats up. It took 2 years and $50,000 to build. Its name is Deep Sound. David's dream was to record sound in the Mariana Trench. That's the deepest part of the ocean. But first came a test run on a research vessel in the Philippine Sea, half as deep as the Mariana Trench, to see if deep sound could withstand deep sea pressure.
I felt young in the company of all these very established senior scientists who were out there. And I was just along for the ride with my little dinky toy instrument that I frankly think people didn't think it was going to work.
After weeks on the open water, David launched Deep Sound. Its hydrophones recorded the whole time it sank, but David couldn't listen to these sounds until it came back, if it came back.
So I had set up this microphone so I could listen the whole time during the drop. And if it was to fail, it would make a very loud noise from the implosion.
He waited and waited, but he didn't hear anything. After 6 solid hours, David knew that if all had gone well, Deep Sound would be coming back up soon, shining a strobe light to signal its location. So he went up to the bridge to look for the light.
When you go look at the ocean when it's dark out, it's just like an incredible wall of black. The few guys on watch have binoculars and just looking at this blackness. And I'm like basically panicking. The blackness is so overwhelming. It's the biggest thing you've ever looked at. It felt like it was a pretty long time, but just totally calm, one of the mates says, "Oh, I see it." And it was just sort of this like glowing orb in the ocean. But even when it's right next to the ship, you're like, how did we get this back?
Deep Sound worked, but sounds at this depth had been recorded before. What David was after was still to come. The Mariana Trench is deeper than Mount Everest is tall. It's freezing cold and completely dark.
6 or 9 months later, I got a chance to go.
The pod goes down, and David listens for the implosion, and again he hears nothing. The strobe light works, and he hauls it on board. But this time, Deep Sound is carrying something incredibly precious.
The amazing thing about this recording was that it was the deepest noise recording ever made, which to me is pretty cool, right?
David had waited years to hear these sounds, but he'd have to wait a little longer. First, he had to back up all the data.
Since it was very late at night, I basically just plugged it in and I went to bed. When I woke up in the morning, it was like being a kid, Christmas morning. I was like, oh my God, I have the deepest recordings ever made. And I get to go listen to them now.
Lean in. What you're hearing is the actual recording Deep Sound brought back from the Mariana Trench. It may not sound like much, but this noise holds information on a place we know less about than the moon.
I don't think being the first or the best or the biggest or the strongest should compel you to do things. You do them because you need to, right? Isn't that like the true essence of like expression?
David Barclay is still in the process of analyzing these recordings. It's not yet clear what he'll learn, but it's certain that they will help to fill in one of the last blank spaces on the map of the world. In Woods Hole, I'm Annie McEwen.
Thanks so much for listening today. If you like what you heard, there is much more at wordofmouthradio.org. And we've got a special request for a new series we're working on called Good Gig. Is there a job you've heard of that sounds like a dream job? Maybe you love water slides and found a job posting for water slide tester. Or if exotic travel is your passion, maybe a job mapping the desert with a camera-toting camel for Google. Or maybe you already have an unusual and amazing job and would like to tell us about it. If so, leave a message on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio, where we've already seen some great responses. John Becker told us about his good gig running a bed and breakfast with his wife and family on Lake Winnesquam. If Facebook is not your thing, send an email to wordofmouth@nhpr.org with good gig in the subject line. I'm Virginia Prescott. Please join us for more Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2 on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by
Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its board of trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.